then I will begin. There was a rock, that since the creation of the world had been worked upon by the pure essences of heaven, and the fine savours of earth, the vigour of sunshine and the grace of moonlight, till at last it became magically pregnant, and one day split open, giving birth to a stone egg, about as big as a playing ball. Fructified by the wind, it developed into a stone monkey, complete with every organ and limb. At once this monkey learned to climb and run, but its first act was to make a bow towards each of the four quarters. As it did so, a steely light darted from this monkey's eyes and flashed as far as the palace of the pole star. Thus starts a book. It's not called Monkey, actually, in the original title. It's actually called The Journey to the West. But I think that probably they felt that the translators into English probably felt that was going to be a bit confusing, and so they called it Monkey. So this is how this story starts. Now, I'm just going to give us, well, ask basically, how many of you have heard of this story, or seen it on the telly, or, you know, come across it in some form or other? Everyone except Richard. Okay.
Poor childhood.
He had a deprived childhood, yeah. Culturally, impoverished.
Boy.
Yeah, yeah. But for a lot of people, myself included, this was actually quite an important part. Not in my childhood as such. I discovered it in a book in my local library, and I think I was about 16 or 17. And I was a voracious reader in those days. And I picked it up and I just devoured it. It was marvellous. It was magical. Wow. What a story. It was incredible. And it's been one of my favourites. And I reread it now and again, every so often. And unfortunately, that particular translation that I read then, I can't get hold of. It's a different one than this one, which is the well-known one, the Arthur Whaley translation, which actually is quite old now. Not sure exactly when it was translated, but it's early 20th century. I do like the language of it, though. It has slightly Edwardian feel, which I quite like. Anyway, so now we have monkey. We have this little monkey born of a stone egg, and he sent this steely light up to the palace of the pole star. Now, there may be little thoughts about what that could possibly mean. I'm not going to actually explore that now. But just think about it. For those of you who have any familiarity with Mahayana Sutras, and I expect all of you should have, or even if you don't, and you said you should start straight away getting that familiarity, may recognize this little image. Anyway, I'm going to leave that for the moment as a little bit of a tease. So I'm just going to carry on with the story. I'm just going to run through it, and then we're going to have opportunities for you to ask me questions. So anytime you want to stop me, you know, and ask me a question, just do so. And we'll see if we can tease out some meaning out of some of the various stories that come out. Okay, so monkey, you know, set this light, this steely light up into the sky. And it went right up to the palace of the pole star. Now, the palace of the pole star is the home of the Jade Emperor, who is, if like, the head of the gods in the Taoist pantheon. And it's interesting that Rataprabha brought in Taoism, because all the way through this book, there's just this mixture between Taoists and Buddhists all along. Sometimes they get on quite well, and other times they're a bit competitive and a bit unpleasant to each other now and again. Most of the time they sort of get on and sort of rub each other up sometimes and get a bit sort of irritated. Or other times he's just really friendly. I mean, the Buddha turns up, or one of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas sort of turn up at the Jade Palace every so often for peach banquets and cups of tea and just to see how things are doing, you know. And Lao Tzu is there, you know, so he's sort of making his elixirs of immortality. Anyway, I'm going to say a little bit about that later on. So we have monkey. And what does monkey do? Monkey is just a monkey. He plays with his monkey friends. he sings, he just frolics, that's the word, he frolics in the trees, he frolics in the bushes. He is, according to this, he's a friend to the wolf, the panther, the tiger, they're all his companions, his kinsmen. He's in good terms with everyone, and his day is filled with play. That's what he does. So it's a lovely image, and he goes on like this for a little while. And it's sort of a bit like what you were saying about Taoism. This is, in a sense, the start of it all. You know, you start in this sort of myth, this sort of legend, epic, if you were, in this sense of play, the sense of enjoyment, of pleasure, without responsibility, without worry, without division, as it were. He is companions with nature. He's in the sort of state of nature, the state of naturalness. But then what happens? One day, the monkeys decide to go and follow a stream. They say, oh, wouldn't it be good if we could find out where this stream comes from? So off they troop. They follow this stream right up into the hills till they come to a great waterfall, which is coming, gushing over these huge black cliffs, you know, thundering down, filling this pool at the bottom. And through that sort of curtain of the waterfall, they can see something there. They don't know what it is, but there's something definitely there. So they say, well, who's going to go and find out? Who's going to be brave enough to go and find out what's behind that curtain? If a monkey, any one of our companions, can go through that curtain of water and find out if there's anything good there, and if he comes back and tell us, we'll make him our king. They all agree, it's all one of our idea. So who goes through first? I think we all know the answer to that one. It was our stone monkey. Off he goes, he jumps through the curtain of water and into this marvellous cave. He discovers this place, this beautiful place. It's like it's cool, it's serene, it's peaceful. It has these sort of stone couches and stone tables and a bridge of iron crossing a chasm. So it's got these marvellous things in there. And he comes out and he says, look what I found. I found us a wonderful home, a wonderful place where we can stay. It's going to be cool in summer and warm in winter. It's going to be a place where we can all meet and gather together, we could be safe and happy there. So they all trip in there, they all go through the curtain of water. And it is, as Monkey said, it's a marvellous place. And, of course, they make him their king. So now he's the Monkey King. And he enjoys himself even more being a Monkey King. But one day, there's a great change in him. He's sitting there drinking with his companions, drinking and eating fruit and having a joke, and then suddenly he stopped dead in his tracks. Suddenly a realization comes to him that he's going to grow old and die. It just suddenly hit him out of the blue completely that he was going to grow old and die. In a sense, this is the end of his childhood. This is the end of that sort of frolicsome nature that he had. This sort of just being with his wolf and tiger companions and with his monkey companions, all that sort of one with nature quality. It's all lost now because suddenly he realizes that there is death. So in a sense, this is, one could say, it's a sort of retelling of the Buddha's life here as well. You know, there's a little echoes of that. There's a little echoes of our own experience. That at some point in our lives, quite often, we sort of wake up. We have a realization that life is not just a bed of roses, or it's not just how we expected it to be. That, you know, it'll end one day. You know, it's not going to last forever. We're not going to last forever. So this was Monkey's realization. This was Monkey's, epiphany, one could say. And what did he do? Well, he didn't just mope. He didn't just, go into a depression or anything. He decided to do something about it. He'd heard there were these beings called the Immortals, who live forever. So he went out to search for them. He crossed oceans. He came to a continent where there were these people, first humans he met. And they were so amazed by his antics, they were almost astounded and actually rather shocked by his antics that they ran away. So he stole their clothes and dressed up himself, so he became, and he learned to speak, he learned to talk. So he made his way through the world, you know, in his little clothes and his, you know, ability to speak, until eventually he came to this mountain. And he heard a woodcutter singing a song about immortals. So he asked the woodcutter, "Where did you get this song from?" "Just up there, in that cave up there. Just see it? There lives an immortal." So he troops up. And I won't go into all this little story about him and the immortal. For some of us here, the name of the immortal's name might be vaguely familiar. It was Subhuti. And he's actually one of the Arahants, or what they call in Chinese, Lohans. And there's a whole myth about myths, a whole series of myths and stories about these Lohans. I mean, in India, you know, the Arahants in Pali canon, you know, they're born, lived and died. You know, in a sense, though they were enlightened, they born, lived and died like us. But in Chinese Buddhism, they had developed this myth of these beings, these enlightened beings, going up to the mountains and living in caves and sort of being there for aeons on aeons, waiting for the next Buddha to turn up. Anyway, so Monkey managed to learn how to be immortal, but also lots and lots of magic tricks. Now, these magic tricks were going to get him into a lot of bother. Right. Okay, so he came back to his cave. And, you know, since he'd been away, things had got from bad to worse, and, you know, demons had appeared, da da. So anyway, cutting a long story short, he gradually sort of got involved in a whole series of machinations and politics and, you know, double dealings and things to do with the dragons of the south and the dragons of the north. Yes, he nicked some from arms from this city. He got and bad terms with the judges of the dead, and it just went on and on. It's interesting, is the Chinese have a very strong developed bureaucracy, even from very early on. And heaven was seen in the same way. You know, the world of the supernatural world was again governed by bureaucracies. And Monkey didn't fit in with bureaucracies. He didn't get on with them at all. You know, so like when the judge of the dead, you know, came to take him away, he said, "But I can't be taken away, I'm the mortal." it might be a, you know, misunderstanding. You got the same name as someone else, you know, but we're taking you away anyway because you're on the list, you know, sorry mate, you know. Anyway, he'd actually gained this iron cudgel, which was made from the metal that had beaten the Milky Way flat. Someone had got this, one of the gods had found this huge bar of iron, and they'd made the Milky Way out of it and beaten it flat. A monkey got hold of it from the dragon of the South Ocean, by threatening him, actually. And so the dragon went up to the Jade Emperor and started and complained about him, and the dragon of the East Ocean complained because he'd stolen a cat from him, and the dragon of the West Ocean because he stole a coat of mail, da da da. On and on and on. Anyway, the gods tried to sort him out by giving him Monkey came up with this title. Great Sage, Equal of Heaven. That's what he wanted to be known. Great Sage of England. So gentlemen said, alright, let's call him Great Sage, Equal of Heaven. And we'll give him a little place to stay. And we give him a small job, but no salary. You know, we won't give him anything else. He won't have a proper job, basically. It's basically one of these things. He can swan around calling himself, you know, Great Sage or whatever he wants. But he's just going to be a monkey, really. Magical monkey, bit of a nuisance, bit hard to control, but still a monkey. So anyway, they built him a little like a pavilion in this peach garden, right? And it's got rooms such as serenity and peace and quiet and tranquility and self-discipline, you know. And he has all these ministers, I'm trying to remember the names now, but you know, it is that sort of name of self-control and, keeping quiet, and, you know, it's like, we obviously, you know, there's a sort of hidden agenda there, and maybe not quite so hidden, of keeping under control. And he first of all goes along with it, but the peach garden is very tempting. All those peaches, all those wonderful peaches. You know, some very small peaches, very delicate peaches. Some medium-sized peaches with all round full flavours. Some really big, incredibly juicy peaches. Anyway, one day the Jade Emperor decided to put on a party. And it was going to be this, it's the sort of, it's basically, it was a peach party. I don't know whether, rather than a beach party, it's a peach party. I don't know, it's a polite way of saying it, actually. They sent these maidens in to pick the peaches from the peach garden. And they invited all these people around. They invited Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara, in other words. They invited Amitabha, they invited Lao Tzu. So it's like they had all, the founder of Tao. So they had all these great people going to be turning up.
The A-list.
This was an A-list party, right? But it didn't quite work out that way because Monkey had already eaten about half of them. He'd gone in there and sort of ate loads of them, and then he went and then stole a lot of the wine and he drank that. And then the worst thing was he went into Lao Tzu's, well, I suppose you'd call it laboratory almost. So he was an alchemist and he was making this elixir of immortality. He made a big vat of it and Monkey drank the lot. So anyway, it ended up in a really bad way, right? Terrible sort of goings on. And Amitabha turned up, the Buddha of the West turns up and sees the whole place in an uproar. Because Monkey, with his big iron cudgel, is hard to control. In fact, he beats the living, whatever it is, out of the gods, and they're sort of running around hiding from him. Well, he's storming around, come on, face me. It's completely running amok. So the Buddha turns up and says, God, what's going on here? Eventually, he sees Monkey and says, come over here. I'm Great Sage, Equal of Heaven. Okay. You're Great Sage. Oh, yes, I've heard of you. I hear you're very good at leaping. Yes, I'm very good at leaping. I can leap for miles, for leagues and leagues and leagues. Okay, says the Buddha, I'll give you a little wager. Now, if you'd like to step on my hand, all right. He's a Buddha, he won't do anything naughty, will he? No. They're good, these guys. Get some of it. Okay, now this is a little wager. If you can leap off my hand, off the palm of my hand, I'll give you the whole of the Jade Emperor's palace. He's going to retire, he can come to live with me in the Western Paradise, it'll be fine, we get on well, he can come live with me, and you can have the lot, you can have all the deities and the planets, they can be all yours, all the stars, and not metaphorically, so literally stars, they can be yours, all the other spirits and fairies and hobgoblins, they can all be yours, the lot. Okay, says Great Sage, Equal Heaven, and he takes this massive leap. One thing he's very good at is leaping. He takes this huge leap and he goes up through the clouds. And then he comes down, and it's in this strange place he's never been before. It's all misty and vague. The only thing, this must be the ends of the earth. Oh look, there's the pillars at the ends of the earth that are holding up the sky, the five of them. Okay, he says, right, I'll just go back, tell the Buddha I've been here. And he thought, now hold on, he's going to ask for evidence, all right. So he takes a hair from the back of his head, blows in it, changes it to a brush with ink on it, and writes on one of the pillars, "Great sage, equal at heaven, was here." Right? And then to make sure there was no misunderstanding about this, relieved himself at the bottom of one of the pillars. So no doubt the monkey was there. He takes his huge leap back and comes back to the hand, the Buddha's hand. So the Buddha says, you've been to the... where have you been? Oh, you've been to the end of the earth. Okay. Says the Buddha. Well, I don't think you did really. You didn't actually get off my hand. Oh, no, come off it. I did it. I actually wrote something and I, you know, did something else. Well, yes, I can see that. Look, it's here. On my finger, you've written, great sage was here. And there's a distinct smell of monkey urine coming from my hand. And he turns his hand up like this, turning them, presses it down. And these become the five elements of Chinese theory. I won't go into all that, man, but anyway. And he pins them down under a mountain, with only his head peeking out, so he can breathe. And he's fed one iron tablet a year, and one little sip of copper juice to keep him going. But that's not the end of the story, ladies and gentlemen. But I'm going to pause there for a moment, because I think you've got a fair idea about the character of monkey. I hope you have from this. So I'm going to ask you, what does monkey represent? There's a lot actually in this text which is, I find it sometimes a bit hard to get out, but there is stuff in here, in this text, in this story, which is not just the full of, you know, adventure story and sort of a kid's story and a fairy story, but actually has allegorical means, an allegorical basis to the story. So what do you think monkey represents?
A conditioned mind.
Yeah, that's a good start. But it's a particular type, a particular aspect of that mind, if you could say. Anyone else? Anyone else can think about how you would, what sort of way this particular part of the conditioned mind?
Not sure, is it the ego?
Ego, yeah. That's definitely the case with him, isn't it? There's a strong ego identity there with monkey. But I'm trying to get a little bit more of the flavour.
Well, thoughtless. I mean, very thoughtless. In terms of what's
yeah.
going on around
yeah.
you. So just what he wants, his own.
Yeah. That's good.
Arrogant.
Yeah.
Poor monkey. He's like base, like animal.
Yeah.
Animal. There's a sort of animal quality, definitely an animal quality. Yeah.
He's pretty gross, isn't he? Peering on the Buddha's fingers.
Yeah.
And it's pretty dualistic as well. It's like this, or, you know.
But he's also quite charming, isn't he? I mean, he's charming. We say, oh, he's terrible to hold up. But I mean, obviously, he's an amusing character as well.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a kind of dual aspect to him.
It is, yeah.
Relate to him.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting, I didn't bring that out in my story really, but in a lot of his dealings with people, he can be actually incredibly charming and pleasant to people, as well as being arrogant and, you know, and all the rest of it. He's quite a mixture, actually.
Quite uncontrollable.
Uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. I think, actually, that's the element which I think is, in a sense, most important. He's what? You describe as monkey mind, using a very original term. So in a sense, it's our own minds. He represents the way, in a sense, the conditioned mind, but the way our mind jumps about from place to place, from thing to thing, in an uncontrolled fashion. There's an image used in Buddhism in the Wheel of Life of consciousness being a monkey up a tree, up a flowering tree. It's like always grabbing hold of things. It's like this constant restless state. And the inability to settle down, the inability to focus, the inability to create a sort of... Well, he's got a certain sort of purpose, but he's most of the time he just spends reacting to the situation around him.
But he's quite daring, though, isn't he? He goes to places that the monkey will go to.
There is a lot of creativity, a lot of courage in him. He's quite brave. He's very brave. There is, in a sense,
He's sort of brave. He lacks intelligence or something, doesn't he?
He's a rebel without a cause, isn't he?
Yeah. Reflection. I think that this is a quality that he doesn't have the quality of self-reflection. He seems to be unable to reflect on himself and on his experience and look at himself. He can't sort of look back at what he does and question it or look at it or analyse it in any sense. He's just this immediacy, or something comes up, whoomp, he goes for it. Peaches, great, I'll go for it. Whatever, he doesn't have a sense of these actions having consequences. So in a sense, from a very basic way, even though in many ways he has a lot of characteristics that are very human, but in a sense of having a distinctively human consciousness from a Buddhist point of view, he doesn't quite get there because he doesn't have, you know, a sense of his actions having consequences and a sense of self-responsibility.
Well, like Peter Pan, he doesn't want to grow up.
Well, in a sense, yes, there is that bit of a quality to him as well, yeah. But
that's what I found quite annoying about the television series, that the character was just like, used to annoy me because he was just so, childish and flighty.
Well, in a sense, that's what he's like. I can't remember. I never saw it actually. So, but you'd have to be rounded up. You have to. In a sense, certainly in the novel, he's more rounded than that. I mean, he does have charm, and he's certainly very intelligent. He learns very quickly. He's very studious. When he wants to learn something, he will learn it. He learned all these magic tricks and managed to fool a load of people. So he's great at fooling people.
He has lots of energy, doesn't he?
Huge amounts of energy. It's unending amount of energy. Anyway, I'm going to continue the story. Now, you remember, I'm just going back slightly, you remember the bit on the Buddha's palm? And he was unable to leap off it? That was not really a trick of the Buddha. What it was, it just showed up one of the other aspects of the monkey mind. Can anyone elucidate? Anyone think that what that might be? His inability to leap off the Buddha's hand.
Imagination.
Yeah, I think in a sense there is his inability to go beyond himself. I think that shows his it goes with the lack of self-reflection. He's unable to make that genuine leap. He thinks he can sort of jump, as it were, because in a sense like we do, when we sort of, our mind's jumping about and we sort of think of this and think of that, and it can sort of produce a certain type of creativity, it's most of the so-called arts and media is created from this sort of monkey mind, but it usually lacks that type of art, if you like. He usually lacks a real genuine depth. There's sort of a genuine move from oneself out to somewhere that's actually different. That's as from one's own experience to the experience of another, or at least in the imaginative sense. So I think this is one of his qualities. He's not able to actually do that. And because of that, he's trapped by the five elements. Which, and I think I would take it here, is just meaning, in a sense, mundane existence. Ordinary, everyday existence. In a sense, he can't get out of it. The Buddha doesn't really trap him, even though, of course, that's what the story says. But in a sense, it's just himself, the limited nature of his mind. His inability to reflect, his inability to really imagine himself. I mean, all the trials and tribulations he's gone through already are usually to do with the fact he's unable to anticipate, how other people could see what he's done, how other people would see it. But this is not, for those of you who know the television series now, this is not the end of the story. Actually, even the sense is not, it's just the beginning. In fact, because the real part of the story, that's all a preliminary actually, folks, The real part, I'm just going to check on the time. Okay.
5 past 9.
The real part actually comes next. And this is where we move from legend into something that touches on history. Just a little bit. It's actually this guy. Swansung. Sorry, he said it to me 3 or 4 times. I thought I'd memorised it, but I haven't quite got it. Swansung, who was an actual person that made the journey to the West. And he's a pilgrim, a translator, a scholar, a government minister, in a sense. He was, I can't remember the exact day he was, the exact year he was born, but basically in 629 AD, or CE, he left China against the emperor's wishes, interestingly enough, with a party to go to India to bring back Buddhist texts. He felt that Buddhism in China at that time didn't really have the genuine article. That in a sense it was a little bit counterfeit. Wasn't quite real. So he put together an expedition and went via overland to India through the Gobi Desert, through various harsh and difficult places, crossing round through what they call the Silk Route, over through Afghanistan, over the mountains and into India. And there he spent quite a few years. In fact, it was 17 years before he got back home. And he made quite a lot of strong connections in India. There's a king called Harsha, who he became a good friend of. He went and stayed at Nalanda University, which is in central India. It was the great sort of Buddhist university, monastic university. He went to Bodh Gaya, where he burst out into tears. You know, he's very moved by the place. And he also, when he was done, one of the reasons why he went is to help him resolve his own doubts. He didn't actually see himself as, you know, an incredible, you know, spiritually advanced person. It was partly that he went there because he had lots of doubts about things. So, but he brought back with him quite a lot of texts, which turned out to be very important for the future development of Chinese Buddhism. So he enters the story now, and the way it's told in here, for those of you who know the television series, is the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin, who is also the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. In a sense, Kuan Yin is already a Chinese version of the original Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is usually is depicted as a male Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva compassion, but the Chinese turned him into a her and became a female Bodhisattva. And it was her that inspired encouraged, I think is the best word, this monk called Tripitaka to go and seek the scriptures in the West, what they usually called India, the West. And Tripitaka is Swansung, basically. This story is written about 1,000 years after the actual historical events. But they made such an impact in China that it was still part of the sort of Chinese folklore, you know, at the time. In a sense, people have sort of commented, it's rather like King Arthur. It's actually close contemporary with King Arthur. So in a sense, this figure had sort of remained in the consciousness, the sort of local, sort of popular consciousness, rather than just a scholarly or Buddhist sort of understanding, but a local sort of common, you know, common people. And they've made lots of myths and stories. Anyway, so Tripitaka had set out on his quest to get the scriptures from India, but he met a lot of problems on the way. He lost all his followers and his baggage and his horse, and was stuck out in the wilderness. But luckily Kuan Yin came to the rescue and directed him towards this mountain. And under this, this is the very mountain the monkey was imprisoned. And he said, well, here's going to be your new disciple. Don't worry about controlling him. Put this little hat on his head. And if he starts becoming nuisance, just say a few verses and it'll tighten. And his eyes will bulge out and he'll scream in pain. No, it doesn't sound very Buddhist to me, but never mind. Monkey's released. And he says, oh, yeah, I'll help you out. No problem. No problem, mate. Yeah. And so off they go. And on their way, they meet another deity called Pigsy. And Pigsy was originally a general in heaven, one of the heavenly generals. But he had a little goings-on with the goddess of the moon during one of these peach parties and was rather considered a little bit... So they kicked him out. And on his way down, he sort of landed badly because he ended up in the womb of a pig, of a sow. So he came out as a pig. Now, Pigsy, and he probably would not be a total surprise from the name, it's quite a different character from Monkey. He's a rather gross sort of character. Well, big and heavy and, you know, has a prestigious appetite. Now, what do you think he represents? This shouldn't be difficult.
Greed.
Greed, yeah. The appetites, if you like. It's just, in a sense, it's the... Whereas Monkey represents more, if you like, the intellect, as it were, or if you could say the conscious mind and the capacity of our reason and our intellect to make all these huge jumps and leaps and the arrogance that comes from that. In a sense, you could say that Monkey represents, from some points of view, that type of thing. But Pigsy represents one's appetites, represents greed, hatred, all these sort of like really basic gutsy emotions. He's the guts. Yeah. So now, there's a couple of other characters coming along. One called Sandy, who's a bit mysterious actually. Nobody really knows what he does, but he's called Sandy. And the horse as well is actually a dragon who was rather naughty in heaven, and he gets reincarnated as a horse and as a penance, and will eventually get enlightened, actually. But that's another story, an enlightened horse.
Is Sandy a human being?
Hmm?
Is Sandy a human being, then?
Not in the story, he's a water monster. But they're all originally deities from heaven. Anyway, so now we actually start on the journey. And so this is the journey from China to the West. Retold as this sort of magical tales, as a series of magical adventures. Now, I'm not going to really go into these stories themselves very much, partly because there's not a lot of time left, but I'm going to mention a few things about them. First thing I'm going to mention, actually, which I didn't mention earlier on, is Monkey's other name. He's got another name. Subhuti gave him this name. It's aware of emptiness. That is his religious name, they say. His ordained name, if you like, for those of us in the Trivatna Buddhist order. Is a sort of an equivalent. Aware of emptiness. Anyone smart at Sanskrit? What would that be? I'm looking at you, Ratna Prabha.
Shunya chitta or something.
Shunya chitta or something, yeah. That is more like empty mind, though, isn't it?
Sati chitta
or something like that, aware of it. Anyway, so one of the characters, I'll go through one of the stories. I'll just briefly run through one of the stories. They turn up at this town. They come in late at night, and as they're coming in, all this sort of groaning and crying out, and the sound of like these big rocks being dropped and smashed, and it all sounds very unpleasant. So Monkey goes off to see what's happening in this town, see what's making that noise. And on the outskirts, he sees all these Buddhist monks moving these big heavy carts full of rubble and rocks and things like that. And overseeing them are these Taoist priests, who treat them rather badly and got whips and, you know, keep up, you know, come on, keep clear, come on, move along, clear that up, do this, pick that up, da-da-da. And there's all these poor Buddhist monks who are rather terrified of this Taoist priest. So, Monkey goes back to the Pitaka and tells them what's happening, and he said, well, we're going to have to go through this town, there's no way around, we're going to have to do it. So they turn up at this town, and they sort of hide, basically. They sort of sneak in, and while they're there, they meet the three immortals, who are these three Taoists, who actually run the place, basically. Because a number of years ago, there was a drought, and there was a competition between the Buddhists and the Taoists about who could make rain. And apparently the Taoists won. So they'd, from that time on, they'd persecuted the Buddhists. But they weren't real Taoists. They were actually animal spirits in disguise. What's interesting about all the stories I've read, it's always about disguise. People who are not actually who they seem. There's two good ones where, you know, someone gets killed and then this spirit or a bandit replaces them, like takes their clothes and actually pretends to be this person, or, you know, or actually takes, you know, the sort of magically transforms themselves into a replica of this person. And that happens at least twice in the two stories that go on that. So this is, you know, a big thing in these stories. Anyway, what happens is that there's a when it all comes out that these people are Buddhists, that Tripitaka and his three companions are Buddhists, the Taoists challenge them to a sort of magical duel. Says, okay, you think you're so smart, we'll get you. And so one of the first one that they do is that they have a meditation contest. Right? And they say, okay, Monkey, can you do it? And Monkey says, I can split mountains. I can traverse the sky. I can plunge into the depth of the sea. I can do all these things. But ask me to sit still for 10 seconds, and I can't. I'm useless. You have to get someone else to do it. Sorry. So Tripitaka says he'll do it, but Monkey says I'll help. So what they do is that both sides build these huge towers made of tables, up, and they float up. The Taoist and Tripitaka float up, one helped by Monk and the other helped by one of the other guys, to the top. Now, there's a sort of whole lot of symbolism about these towers, which I won't go into now because it's running out of time. But while they're up there, the Taoists decide to drop a louse onto Tripitaka's head to get him to move. Because once you've moved, it's the end of the competition. You've lost. And a monkey goes up there as a gnat and finds a louse and then knocks it off and then goes over to the Taoist and changes himself into a centipede and crawls up the guy's nose. So he falls off, not surprisingly. But then the Taoists get very serious and say, okay, there's one more little one, which is very interesting. The Taoists decide between them, well, this guy Monkey, he's been doing all these little tricks for this, he's been changing one thing into another thing. What he can't change is people. You can't change one person into another person. They have to stay the same. So what we're going to do, we have a guessing game. We're going to put someone in a casket and then bring it out Or then we get someone else to put the person in the casket. And then we have a guessing competition about who's in the casket. So the Taoists think they'll have a trick. Okay, we're going to put this young boy in as a little Taoist monk. Or Taoist priest, I suppose you could say. Immortal. And monkey sneaks in through a little crack as an insect. Gets in there and he comes, he says to the little boy, he says, do you know what, I think these Buddhists have got a wind of what we're doing. I think we're going to trick them. You're going to come out, when you come out of this scene, we're going to shave your head, give you a little drum, and you're going to come out as a Buddhist and fool them, right, fool these Buddhists, because they're going to think that you're a Taoist. And I'm going to tell the other people that you're a Buddhist. The Arlot, the other Taoist. You following it so far? I'm looking at Dhammavana going, well, anyway, yes, right. So, if someone is supposed to be a Taoist, has been told to be a Buddhist, and fool the Taoists in thinking it's not a Buddhist.
They're just changing uniforms, basically.
Yeah, it's just what happens basically. They come out and so they say, okay, the Taoists say, it's a Taoist in there. And the Buddhists say, it's a Buddhist in there. Up pops a young boy dressed as a Buddhist. But he doesn't know anything about Buddhism. So the monkey is sort of whispering, you know, so gives them a little mantra, and he chants a little mantra, and they win the competition. It's funny, but actually, in a sense, there's actually a lot in this one. This whole, the identity of the sort of, I think that this is certainly a sort of critique or a sort of satire on what people thought was wrong with Buddhism at the time. In a sense, Buddhists and Taoists were interchangeable. They got rather mixed and muddled up at this point. And certainly in the case of, you know, the instructions given to the young boy to pretend to be a Buddhist was, oh, just chant this mantra, everyone knows it, you must know it, you know. It's just showing up the sort of relative superficiality of the difference. It had gone down, in particularly in this little town, in these instances, to a sort of power struggle, you know, ecclesiastical, rather than a difference of spiritual actual ability. Yeah. I think that's part one could say is a sort of message of that little part. Anyway, it all ends badly for the Taoists, of course, because they get into a competition about chopping heads off. People, they chop their own heads off, but then bad things happen, basically. And the Taoists are revealed as a tiger spirit, a deer spirit, and I think it's a boar spirit. Not as human after all. And going back to monkey, the awareness of emptiness, I think what one could say, 5 minutes to explain emptiness, here we go. starting from now. In a sense, the quick answer to this one is, he was able to see what was really going on. In a sense, it's like he wasn't fooled by appearances. We are constantly fooled by fears, we're deluded. We constantly put onto the nature of our experience all these concepts and essences almost. Like we think we know what the true nature of things are, what it's, you know, Priscilla's true nature, my true nature, this chair's true nature. And we invent all this stuff, basically. And emptiness, in the simplest possible way of explaining it, is it's not really there. All these things that we put onto, all these ideas we put onto things, as it were, isn't really there. It's empty. That's the simplest answer to it. And I think that's a good place to end. Oh, yes. They get to India, and they all get enlightened. And then they... So we all live happily ever after.